selling all colors of the Herman Miller Aeron chair online, including the new color, True Black. Sitforless.com.
We know that summer's a busy time, but please don't forget to support WILL before June 30th. If you've received a letter from us, please send it back right away or call 1-866-779-9455 to renew your membership or make an additional gift. Your support makes a big difference and keeps the news and information programs you depend on coming throughout the summer and all year long. Call 1-866-779-9455. Thanks.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
It's 7 minutes past noon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft, now at the board in Master Control. This afternoon, in this portion of the program, we were scheduled to talk with journalist Rob Walker. He writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. We were going to talk with him about his book, Buying In, the secret dialogue between what we buy and who we are. Well, we haven't been able to reach Mr. Walker this afternoon, so we turn to the archives, and we rebroadcast an interview that we conducted back in 2006, in February of that year, with a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Timothy Egan. He is the author of The Worst Hard Time, the untold story of those who survived the Great American Dust Bowl. As this is a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. Thanks. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Sod-busting drought and wind proved catastrophic for Americans living on the Great Plains in the 1930s. On one day in May of 1934, a windstorm picked up millions of tons of dust. In a new book about the Dust Bowl, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Timothy Egan says that some of that dust, 12 million tons of it, were deposited on Chicago. Even ships at sea, 300 miles off the Atlantic coast, were affected. And that's when folks in the eastern U.S. started to believe there was a problem out west. But that 34 duster, it was not the worst. Egan says the duster that blew up on April 14, 1935, Black Sunday, carried twice as much dirt as was dug out of the earth to create the Panama Canal. Then Egan notes, quote, "The canal took 7 years to dig. The storm lasted a single afternoon." People living on the plains, including Woody Guthrie, wondered if the world was at end. Black Sunday was how he came to write one of his most famous songs about the Dust Bowl.
I've sung this song, but I'll sing it again, of the place that I lived on the wild, windy plains in the month called April, county called Gray, and here's what all of the people there say. So long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is getting my home, and I've got to be drifting along. A dust storm hit, and it hit like thunder. It dusted us over, and it covered us under. Blocked out the traffic and blocked out the sun. Straight for home all the people did run, singing so long. It's been good to know ye. So long, it's been good to know ye. So long, it's been good to know ye.
And the dust, it could kill you. But people survived. Some picked up and moved on. Others stayed on. Egan writes about those who endured in his new book, The Worst Hard Time, the untold story of those who survived the Great American Dust Bowl. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Timothy Egan is a reporter for the New York Times. In 2001, he was part of a team of reporters awarded the Pulitzer Prize for the Times series exploring racial experiences and attitudes across America. The author of five books, his latest, The Worst Hard Time, is published by Houghton Mifflin. Timothy Egans, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Where was Woody Guthrie on Black Sunday?
He was in a small town in the Texas Panhandle, and they had been warned that something was coming their way. They sort of set a phone tree in motion, people calling town to town saying, it's coming your way, it's coming your way. And when the duster hit, he ran into this little one room with several other people. He said he was hovered around a light. It looked like the end of a cigarette butt. That's all they could see was the little glowing end of a light. And people were shrieking that the end is here, the end is here, the end of the world is here. And Guthrie wrote the song later that evening based on what people were saying.
Yeah. What did that storm, Black Sunday, that Black Sunday storm, leave in its wake?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it not only left the kind of memories that have defined people's lives. I mean, you talk to people who are 85 or 90, and they talk about Black Sunday the way you or I might talk about what we had for breakfast this morning, if, in fact, we could remember what we had for breakfast this morning. But it changed policy, too, because the residue of it, about 3 or 4 days later, blew into Washington, D.C., and a person named Hugh Bennett was trying to create the world's first soil conservation service. This is a big effort of Franklin Roosevelt's. And the Congress was skeptical at that point. They were sort of sick of these so-called Okies. Some H.L. Mencken called them inferior people who should be sterilized, and they thought they'd spent enough trying to fix the runaway planes. And Bennett was arguing for creation of the Soil Conservation Service. And as he was arguing before the Congress, the remains of Black Sunday slowly crept toward Washington, D.C., and someone whispered into his ear, it's almost here. It's 2 hours away. Keep going. And so he kept this sort of filibuster up and telling stories. And then finally, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday, the skies went dark outside of Washington, D.C., and Bennett pointed to the window and pointed with the other to the other senators and said, there, gentlemen, is what I'm talking about. There goes the state of Oklahoma. And they created the Soil Conservation Service, the bill creating it that day. Roosevelt signed it, and to this day, it's the only grassroots legacy left over from the New Deal.
Yeah. Lots of interesting characters in this story. Hugh Bennett, one of them.
Yeah, Bennett was one of, I think, my heroes. I mean, he's buried in Arlington National Cemetery for a reason because, I mean, he was a soil scientist from North Carolina who had this sort of storytelling way, but he also was sort of one of the early ecologists, early environmentalists, if you will, who, when he was appointed by Roosevelt to try to save the people and the land in the Dust Bowl, he went out there and said, look, you guys are practicing suicide on the land. He really, you know, took it to them. But he also said, you know, perhaps we can restitch together somewhat of what man has done.
Yeah. Near the conclusion of your introduction, you say, after the Dust Bowl, some farmers got religion. But then again, late in the story, you say the High Plains never fully recovered. And you go on to say at the end of the book that the land continues to be abused.
Yeah, it's a real mixed picture, Celeste, of what's its sort of lasting legacy. And if you drive through the High Plains, the epicenter of the Dust Bowl, which is parts of five states, parts of Colorado, New Mexico, Kansas, the panhandles of Texas and Oklahoma, you not only see what you see throughout a lot of the plains, which is, you know, counties emptying out of its people, towns on the way to becoming ghost towns, abandoned homesteads. You see some farms trying to come back, but you also see, you know, drifting dunes. You see some grasslands that have tried to come back. And then you see these big, giant corporate agri-farms, particularly in Texas, where they're drawing on the Oglala Aquifer, which is this huge body of water, basically the size of the Great Lakes that underlies the Great Plains. And it's being drawn down at a rate that people say is unsustainable, that within 100 years or so it may even be gone, which is astonishing considering it took, you know, millennia for this thing to establish itself. And you know, the sad thing for me as a person for the first time in my career writing a history, I went in after this thing very enthusiastically because it was such an untold story. I mean, most people think the Dust Bowl is Steinbeck and Henry Fonda and Bruce Springsteen songs. But in fact, the larger story is the truer story are the folks who stayed behind, the two-thirds of the people who did not move. But for me, the sad thing, as I started to say, was that, you know, we sort of don't learn. Something like this passes through our history. It's one of the most course, it's the most epic, most haunting events ever to happen. I mean, they judged this the worst weather event of the 20th century, and they judged it the worst, been judged by natural history, natural historians, the worst environmental disaster of our history. And yet you see some people have learned, but others have not. You see shades of it repeating itself.
Yeah. Talk with us now about how government policies, such as the removal of Native Americans and the Homestead Act of 1909, contribute happened.
That's an amazing story because, you know, the whole American policy of the West from basically the 100-year period where the West changed through European settlement was to open the land up, to get rid of the Indians, to get rid of bison. Now, bison, buffalo herds, the largest American bison herd was in the South, the Southern Plains, 30 million of them, existed for one reason. The world's greatest grassland was there. I mean, we had on the Great Plains the second biggest ecosystem in North America, this wondrous grass that Walt Whitman had spoken rhapsodically about as that ever-recurring miracle, this grass that Lewis and Clark had looked at when they came up the Missouri and looked to the west, this waist-high blue stem, this, you know, drought-resistant buffalo grass, that nourished the bison herd, and the bison herd brought people there, Indians, and Indians lived rather well, if nomadically, because of grass and bison. American policy was to remove the bison, remove the Indians, and try to settle as a farming region that arid part of the country. So they enlarged the Homestead Act. You could go, you went from owning 320 acres to 640 acres. And for a while, it really worked. I mean, there was this surge of folks, I call them, you know, the last chancers, the so-called poor white trash from the South, and these amazing Germans from Russia, this diaspora who just transplanted their towns from the Volga region of Russia throughout all of the Southern Plains. And people who basically hadn't owned anything in their lives suddenly could own something. And they did, and it worked for a while. But then it all crashed with the Depression, with the drought. I mean, farming just wasn't meant to take for much of that place because they don't get enough rain. And one of the government's ideas at the midst of this thing, I thought this was an incredible bit of historical irony, was to try to remove the remaining Anglo citizens. They had the Resettlement Act where they pay people to leave and bring back Indians. I mean, it was seriously discussed at the highest policy level of giving this land back to the Indians, thinking, well, you know, what the hell? They knew how to deal with this long ago. But the Indians wanted no part of it because the grass was gone. Mm. And again, without the grass, there's no way to make a living.
Yeah. Did anyone at the time see this coming?
Yes, and this is one of the things that was impressive to me, at least as a researcher here, was that, you know, we look at this thing now through the lens of history 70 years later, mm-hmm. and we say, you know, these knuckleheads, how could they do this? Well, two things. A lot of the people at the height of the farm boom, when they were, you know, wheat crashed, so it forced people to double and triple and quadruple the amount of land they were digging up in an attempt to try to cover their banknotes. It was a classic sort of commodities crash, you know, the price crash, so you had to, like, produce more thinking you'd get enough to cover your banknote. But at the time, some people knew that they were pushing it. I mean, I saw this in diaries, oral histories, and in the interviews I conducted, people said, you know, we sort of sensed this, that we were pushing it, that Mother Nature was going to kick back, that it wasn't right to do what we'd done. Now, the natives, the handful of Indians who were still in the region, had a saying. They would look at all this overturned grass, and they said, wrong side up.
Hmm. You see parallels between the Dust Bowl and the devastation we've seen along our coastal areas from recent hurricanes?
Yeah, there are some parallels. I mean, a couple of things are similar. One is that the Dust Bowl was one of the biggest movements of people in American history, as was Katrina and the Great Mississippi River Flood of 1927. Although the Dust Bowl only took a third of the people out of that region, you're still talking at least a million folks were uprooted from their land. Also, there was warning, as I said. People knew they were doing something wrong. They could see they were pushing it. And, you know, they had this sort of just this great bounty of nature given to them, and human nature sort of did what human nature sometimes does, which is we let greed and hubris get the better of us. The way the parallel changes is in government reaction. Franklin Roosevelt really believed he could restore this land and save these people. And even when his advisors told him there was no political gain in it anymore, I mean, one of Roosevelt's ideas was to plant trees, this huge swath of trees, all down the midsection of the United States from the Canadian border to the Mexican border. And the idea of this so-called shelter belt was that if you had this big swath of trees, 100 miles wide, stretching through the midsection of the United States, it would serve as a windbreak, and people could then farm in between those trees. Well, if you drive throughout the Western Plains today, you'll see these trees, a few of them left, some of them flourishing, some of them just standing dead like, you know, frozen sentinels. Mm. And they sent these conservation workers out, these CCC workers, these armies of people to plant trees. Now, compare that with what we've done in Katrina so far, which seems of somewhat of a muddled response. How do we build? Do we rebuild? There's still sort of a lot of back and forth. But Roosevelt was involved, again, all the way up until there was no political gain. In 1938, I close out my book with Roosevelt's visit to the Southern Plains. And, you know, by the way, he carried Texas by 88%. He carried Oklahoma by 88%. He really believed he could save these people, and they believed in him. Although, I quote one section where just after Roosevelt was elected, he went to the Dakotas to pay a visit to look at the Dust Bowl up there, which wasn't as bad, but it was a drought was on, and Prohibition had just ended, and a farmer held up a sign that said, "Mr. President, you gave us beer, now give us water." Mm. And Roosevelt turned to an aide and said, "The beer was the easy part."
Mm. How many people returned? Did people return?
Well, very few did return. The point of what I was the point I was making earlier is that most people just didn't leave. And the reason they didn't leave is a couple of things. One is they thought this has to end. I mean, when you're in the middle of a decade-long natural disaster / man-caused disaster, you don't know you're in the middle of an epic. You think this thing will be over tomorrow. You think this thing can't go on because, well, we used to have rainy years before. So they thought it had to end. The other thing was most of the people who left the Dust Bowl, the Steinbeck characters, those were largely, you know, they were tenants, people who didn't own land. They were from Missouri and Arkansas and eastern Oklahoma, and they were cotton farmers, and the farm economy just collapsed. So there was nothing for them. The people at the center of the Southern Plains owned their land. They had something. They had a piece of dirt. And even though that piece of dirt was howling and killing them, something called dust pneumonia, I mean, they had these triage hospitals that would, you know, spring up in the high school. Suddenly someone's gym would get taken over and be a Red Cross hospital. Even though you had to put Vaseline in your nose before you could leave the house and going outside was life-threatening. Even though you had to dampen down a sheet and put it in your window and put towels under your door before going to sleep at night, they still believed in something because they had something. Now, they looked at these newsreels of the city during the Great Depression. They saw bread lines. They saw people selling apples. And they said, you know, there's no reason for us to go to the city. What will we do there? So they thought, here, at least, if we stay behind, we'll have something.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Journalist Timothy Egan, our guest today. His latest book, The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now who's waiting for us in Eureka, Illinois, on line 4. Hi.
Hi. Could I ask a series of very short questions?
Sure.
How far east geographically would the Dust Bowl have gone?
Well, the government drew up these maps, sort of like a concentric circles on a target, showing the center of the Dust Bowl being, you know, the Southern Plains, the Oklahoma Panhandle, the Texas Panhandle, southern and eastern Kansas. But then the circle as it widened. This is based, by the way, on how much soil had been stripped away, how eroded the soil was. Mm-hmm. The furthest east, the second and third tiers of the circle went, were well into eastern Nebraska, eastern Kansas, eastern Colorado, just at not quite all the way to the Missouri River, of course, but they went up until it starts to get green there, and basically went as far as the Arizona went. As soon as you got into more rain, 20, 25 inches a year land, that was where the circle stopped, started to end.
That'd be about, say, Kansas City or Omaha?
Yes, exactly.
I see. Secondly, is it true, I read in a Parade article that was talking about, as you mentioned, the depopulation of the Great Plains, that maybe from all the way from northern Texas up to the Dakotas, about a third of the entire counties are losing population and some.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that was actually the impetus for my book. I was working on a series for the New York Times about the death of small town America in the Western Plains. And the census shows that at least a third of the counties in the Western High Plains, I emphasize the Western High Plains, have been depopulated by 20% or more. And this is a trend that started with the Dust Bowl, has continued for 70 years. And if the trends continue, these counties will just be devoid of people. And there's a couple of reasons. I mean, they're away from the interstate. They have no economy in the global economy. They were farm towns that serviced family farmers. And now that we have big farms, you don't need the small towns. The Walmart effect, a whole bunch of things have emptied them out.
Are we talking western Kansas up?
Yes, we're talking western Kansas, western Nebraska, western, most of the Dakotas, eastern Colorado, that part.
And would it be accurate to say that I have some relatives in this, that the Mennonites brought the hard winter wheat from the Ukraine to the plains?
Well, you're very well informed. That's entirely accurate. And they not only brought the that hard wheat was called Turkey Red.
Uh-huh.
But this is something most people don't know. They also brought over tumbleweeds, Russian thistle.
Oh, my goodness, I didn't know.
Which we associate as one of the icons of the West.
Uh-huh.
But interesting, as they came over, they had the turkey red seeds sewn in their vest pockets.
Mm-hmm.
And there were incidental seeds of the tumbleweeds sewn in as well. And so Russian thistle, that's why it's called Russian thistle, is from the Volga region of Russia, which was one of the few things that took to the plains and one of the few things that grew during the Dust Bowl. And interestingly, I heard time and again from people and read it in oral histories that at the worst of the worst hard time, all that people could eat were tumbleweeds, and they would brine them and jar them, can them. They started feeding them to their animals, brine tumbleweed, and then they started eating it themselves.
Are you familiar with Harvey and Marion counties in Kansas? Around Heston, Newton.
Just in a general way.
That's right. And lastly, and I'll get off here, the Ogallala Aquifer, as you said, is, I guess the rates are just, I don't know how you say, a drastic reduction. Would that be an accurate?
Yeah, I mean, the way I put it, just to be fair, is that it's being drawn down at an unsustained rate that shows that in some parts of it, it'll be basically useless and empty in 10 years. Other parts will take longer, but it's not being drawn down in any way that can be sustained. If this was your family well, there would be nothing left for your great-grandchildren.
Does that water most of Kansas and Oklahoma and Nebraska?
Outside of the few irrigation areas, it does. There are irrigation areas that depend on the rivers, the Arkansas River, the Red River, and other rivers which don't really flow that high during dry years. But outside of the irrigation areas, yes, it does water that.
And that would go from the northern part of Texas?
Right, and you're on your fifth question now.
I'm sorry, I'm out of here. I apologize.
That's okay. They're good questions.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call. Other telephone calls are invited. You can join us with the telephone call this afternoon, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You know, I've got up on my computer screen in the studio the current U.S. drought monitor, and things are bad in Texas, Oklahoma, into Arkansas, into southwestern Missouri, up into Nebraska even.
It's been a real dry
year,
a real dry couple of years. And, most people know they had wildfires in Oklahoma in December and January and in the depths of winter when you would least expect it. But they've had very little water. And every time we go through these cycles of drought, people say, oh, here's another Dust Bowl. And the interesting thing about the Dust Bowl, I mean, the plains has always had drought. Drought is part of the ecology, part of the nature of the plains. They've always had high winds. The only difference this time around, it was a bad drought in the 30s. It was an epic drought. But the difference this time around was there was no grass to hold the ground in place. That's the one element that was missing. And that's why I conclude, I guess, like a lot of other folks who've looked at this thing, that it wasn't purely a natural disaster, that the human hand in this thing was quite obvious.
Oh. And we've seen this in our neck of the woods here in Illinois, further in the eastern part of the United States, is when we had the great flood of the Mississippi River. When was it, 1985?
Right. I think it was a little later than that.
Yeah,
yes.
It was. 1995.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Okay. And we saw what the effect of man's hand had been in making that flood
Yeah, because we tried to straighten the river, basically taking away the all the sort of natural cushions as it swayed and moved its way south. You know, again, you like to think we learn from these epics. I mean, you look at the big, big natural disasters or human-caused natural disasters that have shaped American consciousness, the Mississippi River flood of 1927, Hurricane Katrina most recently, the Dust Bowl. And at the time they're going on, people say, well, you know, we'll never do this again. We've learned. But then a few good years go by, and it does fade in the rearview mirror.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the people that you met while you researched the book. One of the survivors you met, a woman by the name of Jeannie Clark, told you she still has nightmares about the dust storms.
Jeannie Clark was an extraordinary woman. Her mother was a Broadway dancer, and she was advised by her doctor, and she took her money from Actors Equity to go west. And for a long time, the advice of people with respiratory problems was to go to the high plains and breathe in that clean, high air. In fact, Colorado City, Colorado, for a while was called Little London because there was it was so full of Brits who'd come from smoggy, industrial, dirty air, the dirty air of London, to go there for clean air. So Jeannie Clark's mother, the Broadway dancer, came to a little town called Lamar, Colorado, which is right near the Kansas border, went there for the air, and the air ended up almost killing Jeannie because she got dust pneumonia, was in one of these triage hospitals, and spent days and days and days coughing up her tiny little lungs trying to hold together. And her mother felt just horrible that she'd come here for her own relief, and this air ended up almost killing Jeannie herself. Jeannie's alive now and lives on oxygen, and was one of the wonderful men and women I met in researching this book who just had this story that was just sitting there about ready to slip to its grave. I mean, these folks are in their 80s and 90s, and when they're gone, this story will be gone. Yeah. So it was a gratifying thing for me to be able to be someone who heard from the living witnesses.
Yeah, great folks.
They're amazing folks. I mean, they started out living in these dugouts, in these, you know, earthen-floored houses. Some of them were sod houses, which is basically just an igloo made of grass. But a dugout was earthen-floored with a plank siding about 3 to 4 feet underground, tin roof. And there was another character named Ike Austin, one of the people I followed. Family of nine lived in one of these dugouts. And, you know, they're still with us. I mean, that's an amazing thing. You think that's such a long ago part of our history, but these people broke the sod, lived through the Dust Bowl, and now are just holding to their memories and basically holding and keeping all that's keeping some of these towns alive.
Yeah. How old is Ike?
Ike is 90 years old right now.
Yeah. And when you met him, he was on a ladder on top
of him. I mean, these people make me feel like a wimp, I have to tell you.
Me too.
I mean, they're just tough sons of guns. And Ike, when I went to interview him, he was I knocked on the door, and his wife came to the door, and she said, well, Ike, he's out up on a ladder. And I went out, and like 25 feet up on this really steep roof, he was sort of bouncing around up on the roof and came down all spry and sat with me for most of the day. Ike was one of the soldiers who landed in World War II in D-Day, fought in the trenches sort of inland from Normandy, and he said the Dust Bowl was harder on him than anything he saw in World War II, or at least had a more searing, lasting memory.
But he went back.
He went back. He went back because his home has that pull, I guess. I mean, he's one of the few people who did go away and come back. Most of the people did not. Once they left, they did not come back.
Tell us about another individual who I was really drawn to him. I mentioned Jeannie still has nightmares. And Melt White, his heart was broken by what happened.
Yeah, he really was. This is a mixed, Melt and Bam White. Bam was the father, Melt was the son. They were a mixed blood family, part Apache, part Anglo, who came down to the Texas Panhandle on a horse-drawn carriage. And the horse, one of their horses died, and then another horse died, and they said they were going to stay in the Texas Panhandle, this town called Dalhart, because, you know, God was telling them something, because that's where their horses died. And it did break their heart, because Melt was a cowboy who was an Indian, and he loved the grass, and he loved the open sky. And like a lot of cowboys, that is, people who, you know, chase cattle across the grassland, they didn't like what the sodbusters were doing. I mean, they didn't like the fact that they were turning this great grass upside down to make way for wheat farms. So it really broke his heart to see this happen. And Melt, by the way, was one of the people who stood by Dalhart all his life. Never left. He died after playing his violin one night in a little shack, and his son describes his fingers bleeding, this blood dripping down on the floor of this little two-room shack the family shared. The mother was always in despair because of the howling winds. And one day, Melt's daddy said, I think I'm sick. Go try to get me something. Melt went to the store and got something for his gut, and 2 days later he was dead. Melt, by the way, is still alive and still lives next to the old ranch in Texas where his daddy used to roam around.
Mm. What's Dalhart like today?
You know, it's lost about a third of its population. It's sort of a crossroads town. It looks, it's kind of vaguely anonymous, like a lot of those towns. Its peak is long since passed. You can see what its past was. They do have a celebration every year of the grasslands. They bring cowboys back and celebrate the day when Dalhart was next to the biggest ranch in the United States.
Mm. Back to Ike and living in the sod house. What was it like? What was daily life like in a sod house, in a dugout, during the Dust Bowl?
It's amazing because when the storms would approach, there was so much electricity in the air, that just this snap crackle, that people said you were afraid to touch each other. You wouldn't shake another person's hand. Now, inside one of those dugouts, they said that you'd open the stove door or touch something metal, and you'd get this huge shock. It would just knock you on your butt almost because it was so strong, they said. And that was because of the static electricity. When the storms came, they felt like they were just entombed because, as I say, they sealed their windows with bed sheets. They sealed their doors. But when you woke up in the morning, and so many people told me the same identical version of the story, when you woke up in the morning, the only thing that was dust-free was the outline on the pillow where your head had been as you slept that night. And people, slept in the kitchen. They were stacked together pretty closely. Like I say, you felt entombed. So you'd go days at a time when you couldn't leave this place. Then you'd go out and you have a hard time recognizing your farm. Ike used to told me about how, his car was buried. They had this old Model T to be buried under dust at one time, or the whole land would be reshaped by one of these storms. I mean, like a giant snowstorm, really. The dust would just drift east to west, north to south, so that you'd have a 10-foot-high drift covering what had been your land. Yeah. And then if you tried to garden, which a lot of people did, as they tried to have these subsistence gardens, and they had their wells for water, I heard this story again, too, and it seems unbelievable, but I heard it enough that it's told in the diaries, too, that it's defies, those who say it defies credulity. The gardens would be electrocuted sometime. The garden would die from the static in the air from one of these big dusters that came along. And sometimes when they would look out and see when these storms approaching, they described it as like, you'd see like the whole, when you approach Colorado from Chicago, and finally you get up near Denver, you see the Rocky Mountains mm-hmm. start to appear, that big, long, brown wall. Well, that's how one of these giant dust storms looked. It was like 100 miles wide at times, 2 miles high, 10,000 feet high. And you'd see but it wasn't a mountain. It was just big, brown thing on the horizon that would approach you.
It sounds to me like a giant, giant, giant tsunami of dust.
Yeah, it was really corrosive. That's the thing. People said, dust is about one-tenth the size of a period at the end of a sentence. But imagine that, a wall of that 2 miles high. And that's why so many people died of this dust pneumonia, because it would get in your lungs and your alveoli, and it would just literally suffocate you. There's a story I tell in the book about a doctor who, this 17-year-old kid is, sturdy, strong farmhand, is sent to see this doctor, and he's having trouble breathing. The doctor looks inside of him and says, "Son, you are just filled up with dirt." And a couple days later, the kid dies. And that's what would happen. It would just literally almost drown from this stuff. But, then it would pass, and a few days would be clear, and they would think, it's over. It's over. The worst is over. This can't keep happening.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Good afternoon. I would like to emphasize in regards to the Dust Bowl that where you described was the erosion part, but the effects of this spread considerably east with the drifting of the wind that blew the sand. I grew up in eastern Oklahoma, and the Dust Bowl, we got the results of the Dust Bowl many, many, many times with the dust coming in. As an example, my wife grew up there too, and we will not sit down at our dinner table unless we get a wet cloth and wipe the dust wipe the table, so as to get rid of the dust, I guess, from that we learned as a child. So I just want to emphasize that the results of it extended quite a bit beyond the area of where that the erosion took place.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct, sir, and thank you for calling with that. The storm that Celeste mentioned at the top of the broadcast, the one before Black Sunday, the one that happened in 1934 that coated much of Chicago with a film of dust, that storm was measured at 1,400 miles in length at its peak. In other words, there was a dust cloud 1,400 miles long stretching from New York. Well, New York was would have been the eastern end of it. Then it later went out to sea. But you're absolutely right. The only way this dust didn't blow was west. It never got over the Rockies. But it blew east, and it covered parts, much of America. Much of the United States got bits and pieces of these storms. And so you'd have huge bits of Oklahoma, huge bits of Texas, huge bits of Kansas would be blowing, you know, as far as Florida, Georgia, the eastern seaboard, Boston, New York, Washington, D.C. Dust blew into the nation's capital. I mean, FDR had it on his desk at one point. He showed photographers it. There's a newsreel I saw of FDR pointing to it. As I said, it blew into the Congress. It was astonishing to have this much of the United States, its land, ripped up, torn, thrown to the skies, and blown around other states.
Thank you very much. I've been enjoying your program today.
Thank you, sir.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the call. Other folks, you are invited to call us as well this afternoon. We've got about 8-9 minutes left in this portion of the program. Our guest today is Timothy Egan. His latest book is The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. What happened to the livestock people had out there on the plains?
That's one of the sadder stories in this generally sad story, is that a lot of the animals died because the dust would bind up their insides. They'd do these autopsies on them and cut them open and just find that their internal organs, their lungs and other things were just full of dust, and they'd die or they'd go blind or they'd choke or the inside of their mouth. When Roosevelt took over, one of his ideas, and this is in 1933, was to see the farm economy had collapsed. Farmers weren't getting, remember, there was no Social Security, no Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, so banks weren't insured, and people lost their savings in banks, which had speculated on the stock market, no food stamps, and no farm price supports. In other words, no farm subsidies. So there's basically no government help in any sense for people in this sort of situation. One of FDR's ideas was, if they could take some animals off the land, that would bring the price up. It was called forced scarcity. So what they did, they went out to the southern plains and other parts of the United States. And again, a lot of these animals were sickly and in really bad shape because there wasn't much forage. And they just shot them. They killed 8 million cattle, I think about 4 million hogs, and gave some of the good meat to canneries, surplus meat, which was distributed in the cities, and others was worthless. And they just put these animals in a ditch and buried them. They thought this would bring up the price by limiting this many animals, but it didn't really help that very much.
Hmm. Were the people compensated?
Yeah, you'd get, I think the amount was $8 a head for cattle, a little less for hogs, which was really nothing because, you know, if you'd raised a cow from the time she was born, you expected a lot more at the end of her life than $8. But yeah, they were compensated, and it gave them a little bit of income, at a time when they had nothing.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Charleston, line 4. Hi. Technical director Jason Croft, could you put on our listener? Thanks. Another piece of business took him away from us this afternoon. So now let's go to our listener in Charleston. Hi there.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Comment, a question. Phenomena, as a light delivery truck driver around middle Illinois, on more than one occasion at late winter, when after the fields have been plowed, the top would be dry, you know, fresh litter turned in the fall or whenever they used to do. I don't know if they still do that, but the wind would blow, and then the snow would all turn black. And that, and not, I think maybe 10 years ago, there was south of Champaign and into Indiana, I think there was a dust storm alert because it was blinding the traffic. And I'd witnessed some of that, you know, in my days on the road too. But I haven't seen that for a while, and I'm wondering if they have stopped fall plowing. That then I live across from a farm field, and it's been naked now for some months. But I wonder if that is still the case. And the other question is, if I missed the early part of the program, I'm sorry, but did was a dust bowl created by taking away the grasses in that part of the country?
Yeah, thanks for the question and the comment. The I can't speak specifically as to whether, you know, it's been reduced because of what they're doing in Illinois right now, but I can say that frequently throughout the Dust Bowl in the late fall and early winter, they would have what they called a snuster, which is a, both a snowstorm and a duster. And they just, the thing you described, it was sort of black or darkened snow. And they say it was one of the most awful things to see, was a black blizzard, basically. The black blizzard was the dust and then mixed with the snow called the snuster. And that really drove people crazy. The other thing is that the winds are always at their peak in the plains around the shoulder seasons, late fall and then early spring. So that's when these things, if there is ground that's prone to taking to the sky, that's when it really will blow. And also, as you mentioned or you asked about, yeah, the reason, the consensus view of what caused the Dust Bowl was they tore up all the grass. There wasn't any sod to hold the earth in place. Then when the land was fallowed because of the drought, that caused all the ground to take to the sky.
Mm. Yes. And is the listener still there? Did you want to follow up?
Yes.
Sure.
I don't know if this is speaking of a sea of grass. You know, I had heard that from when I were young. And a sea of grass, you know, in old movies where the grass would sway with the wind and appear to be water, you know, it was one of those things that, by observation, it appeared to be like the ocean would be, you know, the choppiness or any standing water under pressure of the wind. But I don't know if this is appropriate, but there's a little joke I've known from a long time that two immigrants... we're in the Midwest, and the sea of grass, and a fence post sticking up out. And so they thought they could swim. So one of them got up on the post and dove in and stood up and said to the other, "Be careful, because there's an awful sandbar here." Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's before we run out of time, let's take another call. North of Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to agree with his comment on we don't seem to learn from our past mistakes in the past history. I noticed here in East Central Illinois, we've gotten rid of all the hedgerows, and the winds get very fierce in the spring, and my grandfather, he did work in the CCC camps back in the 30s, and he even took his boys down to Oklahoma to see the sand dunes, the, you know, the blown drifts of dirt. And I just don't know why they don't learn from that, but that, you know, that could happen here, I believe. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks
for
that's
it's interesting your grandfather did that, too, because they folks – really did believe, and there's a lot of evidence that it did work, that at least building these shelter belts and these hedgerows does at least break up the wind somewhat. And so Roosevelt's idea wasn't entirely a crazy one. It did, it's just that it was hard to grow some of these trees during drought, but others did take to the area. The problem is we just, our memory, our institutional memory as a nation, it just sort of fades out rather quickly. And that's what happens. When bad times disappear, you think they'll never come back again.
Let's talk with another caller, a listener in Bourbonnais. Hi.
Hi, two quick and somewhat related questions. Woody Guthrie himself said that the worst thing that happened to the Dust Bowl refugees wasn't the weather, but it was the bankers. And I wonder if you'd comment on that. And then please also tell us a little bit about Woody and how effective he was during the Dust Bowl at consoling and supporting
Two great questions. Thanks for the opportunity. I know we're short on time here, but the banks, it was amazing. And this blew me away. I didn't know this part of this history, but, you know, there were about 1,200 banks a year closing during the Great Depression until FDR basically saved the banking system with an insurance company. And what happened was banks were allowed to take your money, your savings, and speculate on the stock market, and then they didn't have to have a guaranteed amount there. So when the stock market crashed, these banks all crashed, and people called it just legal thievery, legal theft. They were not obligated to pay these savers back. They closed their doors, and that hurt millions of people. Well, it really hurt farm families. The banks closed their door because they had their savings in there. They thought that money was theirs, and it was gone. So your life savings, whatever you had, whatever scratch you had to get you through any bad years, and the bad years were coming. The drought was on its way. That was gone. That set the stage. So, yeah, and people were just furious. I mean, I describe a scene in my book where a mob nearly attacks and closes this bank in Dalhart because it suddenly closes up, and with it goes all their savings. And they feel like these people just robbed them blind.
And that interview was conducted in February of 2006. That was Timothy Egan. He's a National Enterprise reporter for the New York Times and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. We were talking with him a couple years back about his book, The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl. It's 1:53 Central Time. Settlement prices are in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. We'll start in Chicago with the soft red winter wheat futures July contract there. An $8.66 and a quarter settlement price, down a quarter of a cent today. The high at 873.5, the low at 842.25. Settlement price at $8.66 and a quarter, down a quarter. September futures, 891.75, the high, the low at 60. Settlement price at $8.84 and a quarter, unchanged. And December futures in the wheat pit from Chicago, 915, the high, the low at 883.5, a settlement price at $9.08, up 3/4. March contract, 933.75, the high, the low at 903.5, and a settlement price at 928, down a quarter of a cent. The hard red winter wheat in Kansas City settled 11 cents lower today in the nearby contract, with a high of 915, a low at 891, and a settlement price at $9.04. Hard red down 11 in Kansas City. September futures there at 913.75 were down 12.25. And December futures for the spring wheat out of Minneapolis, $9.74 and a quarter. The settlement price down 7.25. Now from the corn pit in Chicago, July futures up 3 cents today. 726.5, the high, the low at 703.5, and a settlement price at 724.25, up 3. September, 740.75, the high, the low at 718.25, a settlement price at 738.75, up 3.25. December futures in the corn pit, 761.5, the high, the low at 38, settlement price at $7.59 and a quarter a bushel, up 3.75 in the March, 775.5, the high, the low at 753, a settlement price at $7.74 and three quarters, up 4.5 for the day. May futures at 782.5, a nickel higher. July oat futures, 419.5, up 4 cents. The high at 24, the low at $4.5. September futures at 432, finished 4 cents higher. July soybean futures, $15.25. The high, the low at $14.89 and three quarters. Settlement price at $15.15 a bushel, down 17.5 cents. August 15.28, the high, the low at $14.93. Settlement price at $15.17, down 18. September futures, 15.06, the high, the low at 14.79 and three quarters. Settlement price at 15.05, down 10.5 cents. In November, 15.06 and three quarters, the high, the low at $14.73 and three quarters. Settlement price at $15.02 and a half, down 6.5 cents. In January futures, $15.19 and a half, the high, the low at $14.90. Settlement price at $15.16 and a quarter, down 5 and three quarters. November of 2009, settled $14.51 and a half, down 7.5. July bean meal futures for the afternoon, $409.50 a ton, the high, the low at $399.60. Settlement price at $4.04, down $7.70. August futures down $7.50 a ton at $401.40. July bean oil, $63.78, the high, the low at $62.44. And a settlement price at $63.27, down $61. August off $60 at $63.61. I'll return in 10 minutes with the closing market report this afternoon, when we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield, or rather Bates Commodities, out of Normal, Illinois, where he serves as their senior grains analyst, at about the futures market. And we'll take up the cash grain market with the folks at the Andersons right here in Champaign County. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
We turn our attention now to the livestock contracts and how they fare today in Chicago at the Mercantile Exchange. It looks like it was a mostly lower day today for the livestock contracts. June live cattle, 96.75, the high 95.82 and a half, the low, the settlement 96.65, up 107 and a half. August 105.25, the high 104.27 and a half, the low, the settlement 104.70, down 15. October 112.40, the high 111.60, the low 112.25, the settlement, that up 22 and a half. December 114 even, the high 113.15, the low, the settlement 113.45, down 7 and a half. August feeder cattle 115 even, the high 112.90, the low 113.05, the settlement, that down 52 and a half. September 116.40, the high 114.40, the low 114.42 and a half, the settlement down 92 and a half. October 117.35, the high 115.65, the final 115.72 and a half, down 110. And November feeder cattle 117.10, the high 116 even, the low 116.22 and a half, the settlement, that down 72 and a half. July lean hog, 77.30, the high, 76.15, the low, the settlement, 76.25, down 92.5 cents. August, 78.95, the high, 77.30, the low, the settlement, 77.35, that finishing down 102.5. October, 77.40, the high, 75.90, the low, the settlement, 76.62.5, down 17.5. And December lean hogs, 78.65, the high, the low, 77.62.5, the settlement, 78 even, down 12.5. July bellies finished up 15 cents today, 73.50, the high, the low, 72.70. July bellies finishing at 73.10, up 15. The Dow is off 2 points at 11,840. The NASDAQ off 8 points at 2398. And the S&P 500 is up a point at 1319. And the price of a barrel of oil in New York up 104 at 136.40.
The late 1960s were a period of social and political upheaval all over the world, not the least in Italy.
The heroes were ourselves. It's silly now to say that, but we thought so, and we were proud of it.
Italians look back at a period of violence and chaos later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
And coming up tomorrow in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine, our guest will be Dana Jennings. He's an editor with the New York Times, and he's the author of Sing Me Back Home, Love, Death, and Country Music. We'll talk with him tomorrow following the 1 o'clock news. It's coming up on 2 o'clock Central Time. Let's take a look at Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. In Illinois and far western Indiana, mostly sunny. Elsewhere in Indiana, a mix of clouds and sunshine with some scattered showers and thunderstorms. Highs ranging from